This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. There is so much happening. Our staff is on high alert throughout the week, collecting the most important news for you. We want to help you to make sense of all of these headlines, all of the events happening throughout the world. And I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. I have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
I have Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK.
Hello.
I have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Robert Morley.
Hello.
Our lead story today is, has World War III already started? You'd think we'd know. I mean, it seems like a funny question to ask. Clearly, we're not in some widespread open conflict like World War II, but what we are seeing is a lot of activity, a lot of headlines, a lot of things going on throughout the world where you have great powers in conflict, but they're attacking in ways that are purposefully designed to avoid an escalation into open warfare. There's an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report that is free. We put this article by Richard Fernandez from PJ Media. It's an excellent article called The War of the Green Men. Let me just read a couple of excerpts from this article to you. He says, since the ability to attack without actually triggering a response confers a distinct advantage, Russia has actually designed a form of warfare to evade the threshold of cultural psychology and avoid the detection of legalistic minds like President Obama's. The approach is called hybrid warfare. And then it gives this definition. Hybrid warfare is a military strategy that blends conventional warfare, irregular warfare, and cyber warfare. By combining kinetic operations with subversive efforts, the aggressor intends to avoid attribution or retribution. Now, one example of this, that's kind of a technical definition there, but the point being that they can do a whole lot taking advantage of the West's determination to avoid war at all costs. And we had an example of this we talked about last week with Jeremiah, the article that he wrote called Putin's Plan in Ukraine, Invade, Wait, Invade. And this article talked about the fact that that President Putin and Russia are basically going in and taking whatever territory they can, then backing off. Maybe they're pushing as far as they can when the West begins to get irritated or they start to act like they're going to respond militarily. Russia says, okay, no, never mind, and they kind of back down, and it diffuses the threat of a response. And he wrote in this article, you know, it's possible that Putin is getting ready to launch a full-scale invasion, but he says it is also likely that Russia's advance could remain intermittent, murky, and somewhat tenuous. Surprise the opposition, then endure their sermons, back off, and bore them until their attention returns to Bruce Jenner and climate change, and after all is quiet, do it all again. Here a little, there a little. Invade, wait, and invade. That's a really dramatic example of this type of warfare, and this Pajamas Media or PJ Media article is built around that. But there are many other examples. We have this massive cyber attack by China where they've stolen personal details of every U.S. federal employee, their social security numbers, bank account information, a lot of personal information. And this has been going on for over a year. Stephen Fleury talked about this on his Trumpet Daily this morning. The administration won't even say that it's China who has done it. This is how they're responding. They're saying, well, we have a good working relationship with China in this area or that area. We don't want to overreact. Well, we're looking into this. We can't prove anything. We are totally dependent on computers, and yet we cannot secure them. And this is a tremendous danger. And you know that China is going to use this. They're not undertaking these cyber attacks and hacking into our computers just for a hobby, something to do. Fernandez talks about the fact that they're possibly doing this in order to identify individuals who can be corrupted or blackmailed or pressured into working for Beijing. Mark Levin has been talking about this on his radio program, how it would be easy for China to just wreak havoc for these employees, stealing from their bank accounts or creating hassles that are going to distract them from more important responsibilities. There's any number of possibilities. A great possibility of an attack on America's electrical grid. I mean, everything that we do in this country depends on it. All of our infrastructure, our distribution of food and everything that we do, our banking is all done electronically. Hacking of this scale, hacking is an act of war. Stealing data on this scale, this is an act of war. These are acts of a hostile power that is probing for weaknesses, that is looking for ways to hurt America, and that has given them an enormous ability to do so, but the American government shrugs. Oh, we can't prove it. You see the same thing with Iranian nuclear negotiations. America is working to get the right language on paper, and Iran is working to end sanctions so that it can ramp up its nuclear activities. It can ramp up its terrorist activities. It can expand its power. They've increased their stockpile of nuclear fuel by over 20% through the 18 months that we've been having these negotiations with them. And meanwhile, the Obama administration has been boasting that Iran has frozen its nuclear program. This is another quote from the PJ Media article. The architects of hybrid warfare knew paper would be their friend. They understood that the liberal West was controlled by lawyers operating under the concept of a rules-based international order. This legalistic system could only see, quote-unquote, certain facts and was blind to others. So with the Islamic State, you see the same story. You see them storming through the Middle East while President Obama is downplaying the threat. It wasn't long ago that his administration was priding itself on having eliminated what it called core al-Qaeda. It just doesn't recognize this as a real threat. The Hernandez article, the administration's visual limits are painfully obvious. It can only see conventional war. When Al Arabiya asked President Obama why he has been so passive in preventing the Syrian civil war, Obama answered like a lawyer. To act would have been in violation of international law. He says none of this has escaped Russian, Chinese, or radical Islamic notice. They've got the president's obvious limits down pat. So this is a huge reality in today's world. And how many people see this? I think this article by Mr. Hernandez does a good job of summarizing this. I'll just read the conclusion of his article. The world stands on the brink of a global cyber war of which China's attacks are but the opening salvos. In the meantime, Putin's little green men are poised to go on the offensive for a second straight year. Michael Weiss asks, can anyone stop Putin's new blitz? A shaky ceasefire in Ukraine was shattered Wednesday morning with a new offensive by Russian-backed troops. How will the White House respond? How will they respond? Simple. By doing nothing. By giving a speech. By increasing domestic surveillance. By denying there's anything to respond to. That's what. Beware the combo of little green men from the Kremlin and the small-minded men from Chicago. It's the perfect storm. This strikes me, gentlemen, as a total failure on the part of this administration to understand and to really appreciate and comprehend the dangers of this world. They're trusting in men. They're trusting in human nature. And like the prophet Jeremiah says, cursed be the man who trusts in man. And this is a curse. And you know that this is going to get a whole lot worse.
They don't even have a good understanding of human nature. I mean, their understanding of human nature seems to be that man is naturally good and man naturally wants to live in peace with each other. But when you look around the world, if you study history, that's not what the natural condition is. It's like Winston Churchill said, you know, history is a chronology of war.
Yeah, you don't even have to look at history to see that we're living in a time of war.
This is really significant because it's just, you know, this is not our grandfather's world anymore. Back when a war was a war and it looked like a war with tanks and soldiers everywhere. And it seems like the West, a lot of our leaders say, well, if we don't see those overt signs, those undeniable indications, then we're just going to sort of excuse it away. However, the leaders like Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, those in the Middle East, they understand this new reality, this paradigm shift. They understand it, and they're saying, as long as we can keep it a little bit murky, give ourselves plausible deniability, like, sure, you can trace those hacks back to Beijing, but the government never authorized it, so don't do anything about it. And they know that we won't, as long as they can put up even a really tenuous defense.
It's like we're playing with a different set of rules. The world plays by one set of rules, and here we have, you know, President Obama talking about how we need to adhere to international law. Well, that's great. That sounds good. But what is Russia doing? They're invading nations. What is China doing? They're going to take Taiwan. So we're handicapping ourselves.
This is in this week's Trumpet Weekly, this informative report that we produce every week that has significant stories throughout all of the news, the best commentary that we could find from the very best sources. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can receive it in your email inbox. Just go online to thetrumpet.com and become a subscriber to The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East. Brent Nachtigall, can you give us the overview of some of the stories from the Middle East we're covering this week?
Some of the stories I thought were significant actually involved Egypt. We have the Islamic State that took another city in Libya. And then in the Sinai Peninsula, we also had an affiliate of the Islamic State, the Sinai Province, as they're calling themselves. They blew up an airport there as well, where peacekeepers are. And then inside Egypt, we had a foiled attack at the Luxor Pyramids. And it just goes to show that Egypt is in a very dangerous situation, and you have Islamists that are trying to destabilize Egypt because of its anti-Islamist leader, President el-Sisi. So Egypt is the place to watch, I think, in the Middle East.
What was the big story that you noticed this week?
The big story that's included in the Trumpet Weekly this week is called Tehran's Siamese Twins. And there's a picture there of it, of Bashar al-Assad and Hassan Nasrallah. Assad, of course, is the leader of Syria, and Nasrallah is the leader of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so this article is pretty important because it talks about how these two leaders, of course, Iranian proxies, and they live and exist by virtue of the fact of Iranian support. And this article details quite well how right now in Syria and in Lebanon, these proxies of Iran are in a dangerous situation. They have lost a lot of territory, as even you've covered in previous programs of Syria. But even Hezbollah is facing some difficulties itself in Lebanon. Now, we have to understand a little bit about geography to see why this is important. Hezbollah occupies eastern Lebanon, which is just a small country above Israel, and it shares a border, its eastern border, with Syria. And then above Lebanon is more territory of Syria that goes all the way to the Mediterranean coast. So without Syria and without Lebanon, Iran doesn't have access point to the Mediterranean. And it doesn't have a good access point to its belligerent acts against Israel as well. So this whole article is showing just the precarious position these two proxies are in. And it talks about how Iran might have even changed its game plan in these two countries by accepting that part of Syria is not going to be under its control, and it's going to increase its military support on the western part of Syria, right by Hezbollah, to ensure that it can maintain that key territory to continue its support there, and its bad acts on Israel. Now, the biggest thing about this article is its conclusion. It's a stunning conclusion because it shows how these proxies are under threat because of the lack of finances that they're facing right now because of the sanctions regime against Iran.
We were just talking last week about how it was likely that Iran would lose Syria, like how much evidence there is that Assad is going to go and that Iran is going to lose it.
Exactly. And obviously that's prophesied to happen eventually and maybe very soon as well, as you covered. But this article talks about just how much Iran cares about these territories. They cannot give them up without a fight. We had the General Soleimani. He's the leader of their al-Quds force, or their paramilitary force of Iran's. He was in northern Syria last week, and he basically came out and said, watch out, world, what we're about to do in Syria, pledging that there was going to be about 15,000 troops that were going to show up in Syria to support the regime there. And then Hezbollah said, hey, talk to its own supporters in Lebanon, saying, we're all in Syria as well. So it was trying to drum up support that way. But I'll just go to this quote at the end here. Considering it just talks about the beginning, considering the dangerous position these proxies are in. He says, Tony Budrum here, writing in Now, it's an internet site, he says, all of this raises an acute question about American foreign policy. Is this really the right moment to provide Iran with a massive cash infusion? The Iranian system is under strain. Wouldn't it make more sense for the United States to exacerbate the strain rather than relieve it? So the United States, they've said that for the signing bonus for the nuclear deal is going to be $50 billion. And the $50 billion question is, what are they going to do with that money? I think it was Jack Lew. He's one of the Treasury secretaries. He came out and said that most of that money will not be used to fund Iranian proxies. He doesn't expect that at all. And then the president came out last week in an interview when he was asked about that comment. He said that Rouhani, the president of Iran, has pledged that he needs to fix the economy. So the president expects that $50 billion or most of it to be used to fixing the Iranian economy. But that's not what's important right now to Iran. Just a small anecdote to show this. Right now, Hezbollah has been functioning on about less than $200 million a year while the sanctions have been going on. And in recent months, that's even been cut back. So where did Hezbollah, Iran's proxy, cut back? Did they cut back on their military side of things? No, they actually cut back on their human services, on their on their ability to provide healthcare for their people in southern Lebanon. They've got this card called the Noir card, and it's kind of like a card where they get deals on going to the hospital or food stamps, kind of things like that, just a social program. And that was cut. So if Iran doesn't care about the social programs for Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they dictate to Hezbollah, no, you're going to use these limited funds, these $200 million or less, to continue your military actions, what are they going to do with $50 billion? We can see what Hezbollah can do with $200 million. So obviously, we've got a situation that is critical for the whole region right there. Iran will not use this money to improve their economy. They will use it to prop up Syria and to prop up Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Brent, you're making too much sense, I'm afraid to say.
Well, that's the problem here. People can see that it makes sense. And we have the U.S. chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mr. Martin Dempsey. He was in Israel on Tuesday, and he was talking to the Israelis, and the Israelis obviously can see what's going to happen with this $50 billion. And they, even he, in front of that audience, did concede that he said, I think they will invest in their surrogates. I think that they might invest in their proxies.
Yeah, that's all the administration needs. They just need to believe it and just say that this is where it's going to go. We talked about this last week, the interview that President Obama did with The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, saying, you know, look, they've made these promises. The money's going to go to the economy. Flies in the face of all evidence. Thank you very much for that. So let's turn now to Europe. Richard Palmer in the UK, what were some of the important items that came out of Europe this week?
Well, we had the economic crisis again with Greece. And at first this week, things were starting to look pretty good. People were getting pretty positive. And then yesterday, the IMF threw up their hands, said, this is getting nowhere, left the meetings about Greece's debt and went home. That threw everyone for a bit of a shock. And now people are just trying to digest that really today. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. And the clock is still ticking towards Greece's deadline for paying back the IMF a couple of billion dollars by the end of the month. Then China this week has been pushing their commercial links with Europe. So far, they've been doing some work on the margins of Europe with places like Hungary and Serbia. And Hungary signed up for China's Silk Road project this week. And China is trying to boost its trade and boost infrastructure and connections with Hungary. And then they also held a major trade expo in China aimed at increasing ties with Central Europe and with Eastern European countries. Then Putin met the Pope, which is interesting. He met the Pope back in 2013, right before he exploded the whole Ukraine crisis. I think that's interesting. I think Putin has a lot of respect for the power of the Vatican and the Vatican's power in Ukraine. And we have no idea what they talked about. It was a completely private meeting, so we can't really do more than speculate. But
what do you suppose European leaders think about the Pope meeting with Putin?
Yeah, I think they're probably not very impressed. They just had the G7 meeting this weekend. Vladimir Putin wasn't invited to those G7 meetings. He hasn't been for some time. And some of the leaders there were saying, well, actually, we don't think we ever want to meet him again at any of these G7 or G8, as they were, meetings when Russia attended. So they're saying we don't ever want to meet with Putin again. They're still sidelining him. And so I don't think they were very keen on seeing the Pope welcoming him and giving him one of these Angel of Peace medallions, etc.
So what was the big story out of Europe this week?
Yeah, well, the big item I'd like to talk about is a push from Germany to make Europe's military less reliant upon the US. And they made a number of big announcements this week and recently. There's an article in the Trumpet Weekly from German Foreign Policy that nicely summarizes them all. But basically, it's a push from Germany for Europe to build up their military technology when it comes to some of these high-tech weapon systems, rather than just buying things from America. So, for example, rather than buying American drones, they want to launch a major project in Europe to build one of their own. And then instead of buying the latest version of America's Patriot missile system, they've got a consortium of companies together, mostly European companies, and they want them to build a system instead. And that consortium of companies includes one US company, Lockheed Martin, and German experts have talked about how this project gives them a rare opportunity to learn some very important technologies from Lockheed Martin and for German companies to gain some of this expertise. That's a fairly big development, and it's a big gamble for Germany, especially for the German Defense Minister, Ursula von der Leyen. If she were to buy an off-the-shelf system like the Patriot missile system from America, that's a lot less risky. It's there, it works, they know how much it's going to cost, etc. Whereas these consortium projects often generate huge cost overruns. They often take much longer. And actually, von der Leyen's predecessor lost his job at the Defense Ministry because of a German project to develop a European drone that ended up costing hundreds of millions of euros and ultimately went nowhere and was completely useless. So politically, it's a very risky decision, but she's prepared to stick her neck out and to go with this and for Europe to try and develop some of its own technology here.
Does this just show how important Europe is considering it to distance itself from the United States to ensure that it's not dependent on a power that it sees as not that reliable?
Right, exactly. And I think that's the biggest part of this story, rather than the weapons they're developing themselves, because a lot of these projects are for weapons a decade or so down the line. The biggest thing to take from this is this determined push from Europe to not rely on what they see as an increasingly unreliable United States. And another thing that ties into that, for example, is they also announced that they were going to spend $4 billion on another four warships. They're about corvette frigate-sized warships, and they've got an option to buy another two. But these warships have a space for a larger crew and more space in there so that they can undertake longer-range missions than the ships that they're replacing. So Germany is planning its future navy to have a much larger reach. They're thinking less in terms of policing the Baltic now and more in terms of having to be involved all around the world.
This seems to be reflecting a considerable will to, say, wage war in the future on the part of certain German elites. But how much of a separation is there between, say, their determination and that of the people?
There was a Gallup poll that came out this week that showed only, I think, around 25% of Germans said they'd be willing to fight for their country. And the idea of Germany taking a stand against Russia is not very popular. A lot of people want Germany to play more of a middle role. One part of this that I think would be popular is the idea of Germany militarily being more independent from the United States. There's a lot, I think there'd be quite a bit of public support that way. So I think that the elites can get support for this by billing it as, rather than a step towards militarism, by billing it as a step away from the United States. And that's a way they can brand it to get people more on board with it.
This is really something that the United States has been pushing for a long time, just telling Germany that it needs to be more independent and take more responsibility for security within Europe so that it can relieve some of that burden from the United States, right?
Right, though I think if this went exactly the way America wanted it to, I think Germany would play a more independent role by just buying many more American weapons. I don't think they'd necessarily be too happy about Germany developing their own version of American weapons. Now, I don't think they'll oppose that. I think for them, the biggest, most important thing is that Europe and Germany starts taking responsibility for its own security. But just financially, they lose out on that.
We've talked about, like, say, Germany using NATO's nukes, using American nukes, and kind of taking advantage of existing technology as a fast track toward military strength. And this is different than that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think it reflects a mindset. And that, I think, is the most significant. Because the other recent development that this German foreign policy article talks about that is very significant, more when it comes to the mindset than the actual capacity, is that Germany is looking at developing a new tank. And they want to work with France to develop a replacement for the Leopard 2 tank. And this, I think, is very interesting because, especially 2 or 3 years ago, all the defense experts were talking about how tanks were obsolete, especially the American defense experts. Because when you're fighting someone like Al-Qaeda and your main military mission is looking for a guy in a cave in Afghanistan, tanks are not very helpful. And so this was their outlook, and this was many American strategists' outlook of wars to come, asymmetrical warfare, tanks are useless. However, Germany is sitting down and saying, actually, we need to embark on this many, many year-long process of developing a new tank. And by doing that, what they're saying is, well, actually, we think we need to be worried about wars with major powers. If you're Germany, that mainly means Russia, just in terms of the closest major power. And this is something that we're going to have to worry about for decades to come, that Russia is going to continually be a threat, that we're going to have to prepare for major power wars. So it shows a completely different thinking about the future of warfare to the United States.
Well, in a sense, you could look at it as a response to America's weakness, America's pulling back. But in another sense, it's equally, if not more, a response to Russian aggression, Chinese extension of its hegemony.
Exactly. And you just had Russia bring out their new tank, and they're now it's going to take them some time to roll it out. Russia has a very similar view. They're obviously preparing for big multi-power type wars.
Very interesting, Richard. Thank you very much for bringing us that story. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can go there and receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Coming up next, news from Asia, from America, and later, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We're going to take a look now at Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, our man watching the Asian continent, what were the big stories out of Asia this week?
China conducted military exercises this week near Taiwan and the Philippines. That was on Wednesday. And the location of these drills has really caused a lot of alarm because both Taiwan and the Philippines are very concerned about China's increasing belligerence, especially as that belligerence is biting into their territories. Then there was also a piece that we have in there. It's about lurking nationalism that is threatening all of Asia. Given Asia's diverse mosaic of culture and religion, nationalism is always just below the surface there. And this piece in the South China Morning Post says that it could be just on the cusp of boiling over right now. Then Russia made headlines this week announcing that it has plans to boost its gold reserves to a staggering $500 billion. There's a piece by Russia Insider which just talks about some of the economic implications that this boost will have around the world.
And the big story this week, in your view?
The big story is that China is building the most extensive global commercial/military empire in history. This powerful article by Steve Levine points out that plenty of people are talking about Beijing's resource grab in Africa and elsewhere. Plenty of people are talking about China's construction of militarized artificial islands in the South China Sea. And there's no shortage of stories about Beijing's new strategy to project naval power broadly in the open seas. But what most reporters fail to do is connect the dots on all of these remarkable projects. So Levine says that most onlookers tend to consider China's ambitions in sort of disconnected pieces. But if you connect those dots and look at the entire picture, you see a whole lattice work of infrastructure materializing around the world. And Levine says that if you add China's official government activities to its business activities of its various corporations and companies, then it all adds up to, I'll just quote Levine here, they are quickly growing into history's most extensive global commercial and military empire. So this article does a fantastic job of connecting those dots of China's rapid rise all around the world. Levine says that the story really starts with a reimagined Silk Road. This is an intricate network of railroads and roads also and ports that sort of rebuild the old fabled east-west Silk Road trading route between China and Central Asia and Europe. And the idea is just massive in scope. You've got a railroad that's 1,125 miles long. It's a bullet train, actually, that's going to punch straight through Pakistan and go to the port of Gwadar there in the Arabian Sea. Another one that's over 8,000 miles long, connecting China to Madrid, Spain, all the way across Europe there. Then the article, he goes into all kinds of details about every region of the world there. He spends some time in South America, where Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, has pledged $250 billion of investment over the next 10 years. $10 billion of that has gone for a 3,300-mile high-speed railroad. And he also talks about the project that China has initiated to build a new canal through Nicaragua. This is just a huge story where they're spending $50 billion to dig 170 miles out of Nicaragua there. It's really slicing the continents apart. And this is... it's going to be a huge boon to China's economy and its presence there in South America if this materializes. And it appears that they've already broken ground on that. Levine also talks about Africa and all the inroads that China's made into Africa. Railroads, roads, airports, all kinds of things. There's activity in all 54 African nations where China's just doing all that they can in there. One fascinating thing about China's development is that unlike Washington, who sort of does development projects and assistance to countries based on conditions of good governance, Berlin couldn't care less about that. While the Western powers sort of sermonize and we try to punish authoritarian actions by withholding aid or even withholding development and whatnot, China's more than happy to build palaces for tyrants, to build, summer villas for despots. It guarantees these types of authoritarian rulers territorial integrity regardless of any sorts of human rights violations they may be committing.
So it opens up a lot of opportunities that the United States wouldn't take.
Yes, that's right, because they don't have the scruples that we would or that we would at least profess to have.
Well, it's amazing to look at all of this in light of what we were talking about earlier in the program with this massive cyber attack by China. You talked about how the media isn't connecting the dots with these various programs, but it seems like, more importantly, the U.S. government isn't connecting the dots.
That's right. It seems like, for the most part, even our policymakers, even world leaders, really fail to put this all together in one picture and say, wow, what is materializing here is the largest global, commercial and military empire in history. Very few people see that. If you continue through Levine's piece, he goes into China's neighbors there, Laos, Thailand, Malaysia, just all the influence that China has there. And even further afield in the Pacific, Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, and then Pakistan. China recently lavished $42 billion in infrastructure projects on Pakistan. All throughout Central Asia, there's more development. I mean, this really is a global project. It's everywhere, every continent. Even in the U.S., there's all sorts of Chinese investment. They're buying up American real estate left and right. And then also, last but not least, China has polar ambitions. Their territory goes all the way to the Arctic Circle, 1,000 miles from China, and yet they're really investing a lot to develop that.
I'm sure that China's neighbors are looking at these facts and they're connecting the dots and they're seeing what China is doing and they're going to respond accordingly. I mean, Japan, they're trying to position themselves. They're recognizing China's ascension and America's disappearance. The Philippines sees it. And those other countries that you mentioned where China's presence is increasing, they're seeing it. And you know that this is reshaping the entire face of Asia.
It is. It's really reshaping the entire face of the globe. More than 200 years ago, Napoleon Bonaparte nicknamed China the Sleeping Dragon. And he advised the European leaders of his day not to awaken it. But today, you see that that dragon is wide awake, and it really is reshaping the face of Asia and beyond.
Well, the other power that has to be looking at this and connecting the dots is Europe. We talk a lot about how the major events within Asia are basically instilling a certain sense of fear within Europe and a certain sense of a responsibility and obligation to step up and take action, seeing just how aggressive these Asian powers, China and also Russia, are looking these days.
That's true, especially in Latin America, which has always been viewed by Europe as sort of a cultural cousin. You know, they share the language, Spanish and Portuguese. They share religion, Catholicism. And yet, China and Russia are suddenly really moving into Latin America, not just the Nicaraguan Canal, but all sorts of railway projects. Russia is building some nuclear power facilities for several Latin American nations. And you have to think that Europe is not going to sit idly by and just allow these Asian nations to sort of continue their inroads into what it's always viewed as its sister continent.
It's a huge story. I appreciate you bringing it to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on KPCG 101.3 FM from Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our week in review, looking back over the big headlines from this past week. We're going to turn our attention now finally to America. Robert Morley, what was the important news this week?
Well, Russia seems to be getting serious about shifting away from using dollars. Reports emerged this week that Russia, for the first time, is going to issue debt denominated in Chinese yuan as opposed to U.S. dollars. And this is part of a trend that we've been watching very closely, the world trying to find financial mechanisms outside the U.S. financial system. And we see here Russia trying to lead the way. There is chaos in St. Paul schools. This is something that we talked about last week on the program. We have an article in there with a little more analysis on this. There is a connection between our self-destructing education system in St. Paul and the riots in Baltimore and other cities in America.
All right, Robert, the top story.
So the big story this week, I think, in America was this pool party in McKinney, Texas, where the white police officer was accused of pulling a gun on a crowd of teenagers and shoving this black teenager into the ground because he was a racist. It's been all over the news. We're seeing these stories, but now we're seeing that the other side of the story is finally coming out. And guess what? We find that this story isn't about race at all. So here's what happened. There's a pool party for a graduation. The community has a community center with a pool. There's about 100 kids in attendance. And then somebody there posts on social media that there's a pool party and outsiders start arriving at this pool. They're not allowed in because they're from outside the community. It's against the community rules to have more than two guests from outside the community. That's not going to stop these thugs that came into the community. They start climbing over the fence. They start picking fights. Fights break out in there. They assault two security guards. A mother and her daughter are attacked. Chaos starts breaking up. Property is being damaged. Somebody calls the police. The police arrive on the scene. This is what's going on when those officers arrived at the pool party. You know, that's the backstory of what happened here. And the media is all ablaze about police racism. We see the officer now, he's resigned. He can't work there anymore because he's been stigmatized. He's been called a racist. And he's been receiving multiple death threats. But here's what I find interesting about the story. And this is the reaction of the community members that actually live there. They are telling people, they're even going on television and radio shows telling people that this isn't about racism. They're saying they have a good relationship with the police in that community. You know, they're saying, look, this is where we have these outsiders coming in here, barging into this into our pool at the community center, harassing people. Kids were smoking weed. They were drunk. They were out of control. They wouldn't listen to any of the adults. And some of the parents are saying, we thank the police for arriving. And we're glad that they came here to help disperse that. One of the members of the community went on the radio to give his view. And afterwards, he started getting death threats from people. He lives in that community. He said that later on, the next weekend, these same thugs were back in the community. They kicked in the door. They vandalized a dozen cars. There was thefts the next weekend. Retribution for actually going out and saying, hey, this wasn't about race. This was about thugs coming into our community. So now that people are actually speaking out, word is getting out there. We're seeing that, you know, no, this isn't a story about racism. This is a story about thugs and police, a police officer that maybe went a little bit overboard in his, maybe he shouldn't have pulled the gun. I don't know police procedures. You know, maybe that was something that should not have happened there. But when you have two guys running at you like that and a crowd around you and you don't know what's happening, you could kind of see why he might do that.
We just keep coming back to these stories that undermine the authority of law enforcement, that cause law enforcement officers to become more timid, more afraid of getting kickback for doing their jobs. And in this case, who are these kids that came in there? I mean, you just wonder, it's almost like there are these people that are, they're intent on wreaking havoc from the very beginning, and they're taking advantage of situations like this where they're able to kind of stir up mayhem, knowing that it's easy for something like this to blow up into a race question rather than a simple law and order, keeping things under control question.
I think that's the biggest thing that this story shows, and that's just how primed this nation is. It doesn't take a lot to set it off. We talked about, you know, the protesters that showed up. A lot of those protesters, you know, there's reports coming out, they aren't from the community. They're from outside. These are people that this is a big issue for them, and they want to show up.
It's also about just how much the media latches on to anything that seems to confirm this narrative that they're interested in promoting right now, and that is about racism, endemic racism within the police force. And again, it's not like there's no problem, but here's a situation where there really isn't a problem. That's not the issue. You have black residents in the community who were a witness to it, who said that's not what this is about, but they are insisting that this is what it's about. And it just catches fire and blows up irrespective of all facts. The facts do not matter. You see this in case after case where the reality of what happened is shoved aside, an inflated, distorted, perverse version of events is promoted, and the story makes the news and the headlines are all of there. It gets people agitated emotionally, and the problem continues to get worse.
CNN had a story about this, and the writer obviously was from the perspective that this is racism. This story is racism. At the end, she said, nobody could watch this video and not conclude that if those kids over there were white, that this would have happened. It only happened because they were black. And you can look at that video, and I encourage anybody out there who's listening to go and look at the video and see if you come to that conclusion on your own. Look at the facts. And I think if you dig into the facts, you'll come to a very different conclusion than the narrative that's been shoved in our faces on this issue.
Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we're talking about are in that report. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That is coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. There's so much news to report. We want to squeeze as much into the show as we possibly can. We're going to start with Brent, the second most important item that you noticed this week.
The second most important story I have this week has to do with how desperate the United States is to have a nuclear deal with Iran. Now, last week, the leader of Iran came out and said that he wouldn't allow UN inspectors to look at their nuclear sites. Now, this is something that's very important for the UN to be able to do, to see whether they're breaking the rules or not. And this was, surprisingly, it was the EU that came out and said, no, If we're going to sign off on a nuclear deal, we are going to have those sites inspected by our lab coats on the ground. We want people there to see and to monitor what you're doing. So this presented a difficult situation, an impasse for the United States that wants this deal. So what did they do? So the story that's in the Trumpet Weekly this week talks about how they sent CIA Director John Brennan to Israel this week to potentially try and discuss why it wasn't essential that these nuclear inspectors were down there on the ground in Iran to look at the nuclear program. This article was broken by Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute, and the report says this: under these circumstances, it seems the head of the CIA, John Brennan, was sent to Israel to convince it, and through it, the European Union, that intelligence monitoring of every suspected instance of a military dimension in the Iranian nuclear program is a sufficient solution. So they're saying, the CIA director is saying, hey, as long as we just monitor it from afar, that's all that we need. And the EU is saying, no, we want people on the ground. And it's just producing a great problem for the United States in these negotiations.
Richard, your second most important story.
Well, that was a Pew survey that found that most people, or a lot of people in NATO, do not want to defend their NATO allies. So absolutely fundamental to NATO is this Article 5 commitment that an attack on any one NATO state is an attack on all of them. So if Russia decides to invade Latvia, then according to this NATO article, then Germany, then France, then America, then Italy, etc., then they're all instantly at war with Russia, and they're going to respond to that attack. But the survey came out this week from Pew that really undermines that, and they found that in Germany, 58% of Germans said that Germany shouldn't respond to a Russian attack on a NATO member. And in France, it was also 53%. Italy, it was above 50%. Only in the US and Canada did a majority of those surveyed believe that their nation should respond militarily to an attack on a NATO member from Russia. And in the Trumpet Weekly this week, we have an editorial from the Times of London where they go back to an Oxford Union debate back in 1933 when Britain's top up-and-coming intellectuals voted for the motion, "This House will under no circumstances fight for king on country." And people like Hitler and even Mussolini took note of this motion, and they took the message that the UK doesn't want to fight, its young people don't have a will to defend themselves, and it contributed to this build-up and to Germany and Italy being very pushy because they thought that Britain would be a pushover based on that response. And so the Times article makes that point that this type of opinion can be very dangerous.
Jeremiah, your second most important story this week.
Russia and China are stepping up cooperation in Central Asia. Now, I think this is a really significant story because Central Asia, for the last two centuries, really, has been almost the exclusive playground of Russia. But now, suddenly, in matters of cash, at least, China is quickly moving in. So in terms of muscle, Central Asia still is Russia's playground, essentially. But it's interesting because what Russia lacks, China has. And what China lacks, Russia has. So it's a really strategic partnership that they have there. And they're basically just agreeing to increase their engagement in Central Asia and also to coordinate their policies in all of these former Soviet territories in Eurasia. So if you think about what both can get from this, they really both have a lot to gain. Russia will gain access to the Silk Road Construction Fund. We talked about that at the beginning. This is really a China-driven initiative, and Russia's going to be able to tap right into it. China will be able to get a reliable transit point to Europe. This really just is more evidence of this rapidly growing Russia-China partnership, and it's evidence that the Western policy of trying to isolate Russia, it has failed. It's failed really miserably, and this policy has only served to push Russia deeper into China's arms.
Robert, another story that raised your eyebrow in this week's report.
Well, Germany is set to become the fourth largest shareholder in China's new bank. That's that Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. It's something that we've talked about before in this program. This is that bank that China has marketed as an alternative to the U.S.-dominated World Bank. And now we're finding out who's actually going to own this bank. We see that China is going to have the biggest share than India and Russia. And then Germany will be that fourth largest bank. And this is interesting because America lobbied so hard against the creation of this bank. America tried to stop its allies, its closest allies, from joining this bank, which the United States said was a threat to basically the peacefulness of the world. It was going to be a policy tool used by China to push its influence through the world. So it's interesting to see America's allies, specifically in this case Germany, willing to defy America and join this bank, and Australia with being the fifth largest holder, also another traditional U.S. ally, deciding to push ahead and join this initiative that is very anti-American.
What struck me this week, and it's in this week's Trumpet Weekly, this is actually an article that is from a year ago. It's been trending, it's been looked at a lot this week, but it's from June 12th, 2014, an article in the Wall Street Journal by University Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Paul McHugh. The title of the article, Transgender Surgery Isn't the Solution, and it's for obvious reasons in the news now, and it's extremely relevant. But this is right after the Department of Health and Human Services Review Board ruled that Medicare can pay for the reassignment surgery sought by the transgendered, people who say they don't identify with their biological sex. There's a lot of details in this story about how the government is essentially forcing this issue of transgenderism to the front, and it's treating it like it's a new front in the civil rights movement. It says advocates for transgendered have persuaded several states to pass laws barring psychiatrists, even with parental permission, from striving to restore natural gender feelings to a transgendered minor. The child is confused about this. The parents say, oh, we want to help them. The states say, no, you cannot do that. It says that government can intrude into parents' rights to seek help in guiding their children indicates how powerful these advocates have become. There's an example in here about misguided doctors at medical centers, including Boston's Children's Hospital, have begun trying to treat this behavior by administering puberty-delaying hormones to render later sex change surgeries less onerous, even though the drugs stunt the children's growth and risk causing sterility. And 80% of the children that have these feelings would abandon their confusion and grow naturally into adult life if left untreated. So this man says these medical interventions come close to child abuse. They are so convinced that that this feeling of that I'm somehow not the gender that I was born, that this is absolutely something that cannot be questioned. And this is what this university professor says, Paul McHugh. He said, this intensely felt sense of being transgendered constitutes a mental disorder in two respects. The first is that the idea of sex misalignment is simply mistaken. It does not correspond with physical reality. The second is that it can lead to grim psychological outcomes. And he gives several examples of studies that show just how detrimental it can be to these folks who follow through with these procedures. But he says the transgendered suffer a disorder of assumption like those in other disorders familiar to psychiatrists. Other kinds of disorders assumptions are held by those who suffer from anorexia and bulimia nervosa, where the assumption that departs from physical reality is the belief by the dangerously thin that they are overweight. I thought that was an excellent comparison, that if you're talking to someone who is wafer thin, and she thinks she's fat, are you going to send her to get a liposuction treatment? No, you're going to say, you have to understand reality. Like, we need to help you to see that the way that you think is off. But this article is just an excellent look at the reality of what happens to those who go through with these procedures, and they have perfectly functional body parts chopped off and procedures done that alter them in ways that are proven now to have no benefit to their psychological composition. In fact, they tend to increase more dysfunctions and more problems and suicide rates and all of those types of things. He concludes this article claiming that this is a civil rights matter and encouraging surgical intervention is in reality to collaborate with and promote a mental disorder. You are listening to The Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we talked about on today's program are there. We've got links to the Trumpet articles that give you even more analysis, more explanation. We'll even give you a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd appreciate your thoughts, your questions. You can email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook or Google Plus. I want to thank our panel today, Brent Noctegal, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley. Thank you, gentlemen.
It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I want to leave you with the words of Dale Carnegie. Do the hard jobs first. The easy jobs will take care of themselves. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.